You're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, episode number 22.
I'm a doctor. I've lived for over 2,000 years.
I am Scottish. I can complain about things.
Shush.
Hi, I'm Dom Bettinelli, and you're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, where we discuss the latest episodes of the hit series Doctor Who. Today we're discussing the 2016 Christmas special, The Return of Dr. Mysterio. Joining me today on the panel are Father Corey Stika from Malta, Montana. Hi, Father Corey.
How's it going?
Great, thank you. And Jimmy Akin from San Diego. Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy.
And Stephanie Zimmer from Milwaukee. Stephanie, you're from Milwaukee, right?
Correct.
Okay. I don't know. I didn't write it down. I have everybody else's place. Hi, Stephanie. Welcome.
Hello.
So, hey, it's great to be back together again, everyone. It's been a while. As we said before we started recording, it's been a year since we've recorded an episode. So how are you doing with the Doctor Who drought? Jimmy, how's it been? What have you been up to since then? You've been watching all the old episodes? Anything good stand out from those?
Well, one of the things that was really interesting that happened just a couple of months ago was the BBC released an animated reconstruction of the very first Patrick Troughton episode. He was the second Doctor. And so this was his very first episode where the first time regeneration had ever happened on the show. Previous to that, it had not been even heard of. Mm-hmm. And then one day, the first Doctor, William Hartnell, fell down and regenerated as Patrick Troughton. And so the very first series of his was called Power of the Daleks. It was a six-parter, and it was lost. And so they took the existing audio and added animated video to that to let people see what it would have looked like. And you can get it on Amazon if you care to check it out. It's a fascinating look at an early period in Doctor Who's history.
Is it on Amazon streaming, or is it like a video you have to purchase?
I don't think it's part of Prime, so I don't think it's free. But for a Doctor Who aficionado, you know, paying a few bucks to get to see Patrick Troughton's first and the first ever regeneration story is really cool.
Oh, yeah.
If you have cable or satellite that has BBC America, you can also sign up on their website and watch it for free there and in color. They've colorized it as well for the online streaming.
Oh, great.
Cool.
Excellent. Yeah, the original animation they did is in black and white, as of course the original broadcast was.
Right.
Now, did I see that there was another old Christmas episode that the BBC America has also put online for streaming? I heard something about it, but in the rush of Christmas and all, I missed it, and I don't even know if it's still available. Did anybody remember?
There wasn't a Christmas episode, but BBC America also put up an old Fourth Doctor episode where he was in Paris. Was that what's the name?
Oh, right.
City of Death.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And that's kind of a classic one. That was one that was written by Douglas Adams of Hitchhiker's fame.
Oh,
so
great.
It's very campy, a lot of fun. It's one of my favorite Fourth Doctor episodes.
Yeah, that's one that has a cameo by John Cleese in it, where the TARDIS has materialized in an art museum, and John Cleese of Monty Python is playing an art patron who is admiring the TARDIS as if it's a work of art.
That sounds awesome. You know, the we've been threatening to do some episodes of Secrets of Doctor Who on older series, older Doctors. We really ought to do that one of these days, even maybe for one of these or both of these episodes even. But that sounds great. I'm going to have to catch those very soon. I doubt that they'll be streaming forever, so we'll have to catch those as soon as we can.
Another Gee Whiz trivia, a Star Wars crossover, the Count in there, is the actor Julian Glover, who was one of the commanders in Return of the Jedi, I believe it was. He was of the commanders of one of the Walkers.
Oh, funny.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's a a British actor who does get around a bit. So, that's great. Yeah, I love seeing watching British shows, and especially even contemporary ones, and seeing all the Doctor Who actors, whether it's the current stars, like in Broadchurch, you have David Tennant and the fellow plays Rory, and then as well as the
Arthur Dark.
Yes, and people just keep showing up, and so it's all these Doctor Who connections. So great, awesome. So so that's some old Doctor, now some new Doctor. Like I said, it's been a year since we've gotten together. The last episode of Doctor Who that we got to see was the 2015 Christmas special, The Husbands of River Song. We won't have to wait as long for more Doctor Who. That's been announced at the same time as this Christmas special was airing, that Series 10 will begin airing the spring, perhaps this April. That's I've heard. We're definitely getting it the spring, but we didn't get a definitive date from the BBC, but it's been bandied about that April would be the time frame.
Easter is one of the traditional launch dates for Doctor Who.
Yeah, as I was looking back over previous seasons. Again, longtime listeners and Doctor Who aficionados know that in Britain they call them series, what we call seasons in the U.S. So we'll end up using that interchangeably. But yes, series often start off in around Easter time. It's very interesting, the Christmas Easter connections that the British television seems to have, even if the content isn't particularly religious outwardly. So far as being Christian in that sense, but we're here to find those Christian connections wherever they are. Well, that's one of the things we like to do is talk about where it intersects with the bigger themes. So when we left the Doctor, he and River Song were at the singing towers of what was that called? Oh, I had that.
Deryllium.
Yes, and we knew from the Silence in the Library episode that this was the last place that River would be right before going to the library for her denouement, the backwards end of her appearances on Doctor Who. And so they had a single night together, and then the Doctor reveals that Nights on Deryllium are 24 years long, which, you know, is nice for River, but must be really dreary for those who live there.
Slow rotating planet.
Right. Yes. So then we this is immediately following that, essentially. The Doctor doesn't have Clara, his companion. He's, as we often see in these Christmas episodes that are sort of interstitial between companions, he's alone, but sort of picks someone up along the way. And we'll get into who he's picked up because it's a kind of a fun reveal, but the open here is passing through a comic book. So we have this comic book drawing on the screen, and then we sort of pass through the comic books, or that idea, we're entering into a comic book story, into what I would say is probably a British person's very New York idea of what New York is. So you have these brownstones, and you have lots of noise of cars, and you have an American flag flying from a fire escape and a Joe's Pizza. I mean, it's very, like, you cannot mistake this. This is not London anywhere. This is New York. And then we go into this. What's that, Stephanie?
A CGI version of New York that's not very convincing.
Yeah, right. And then we kind of fly into this bedroom, and we flash back and forth between this adult, who we will learn his name is Grant, and a young Grant sleeping. And then we find the Doctor kind of swinging on a rope from his feet outside young Grant's window.
Incidentally, there's, yeah, for people who actually read comic books, of which I am one, there's an interesting bit of detail that you'd realize if you're a comic book fan, that cues you to which time period we're in. Because if you look at the comic book on the adult Grant's nightstand, it uses glossy paper and has black borders in the gutters between the frames. But then when we cut back to 1986 for the young Grant, it's a newsprint comic book with white gutters between the panels. And that reflects the changing production values of comics over the years. And so they actually, someone who knows something about comic book production and how it's changed is responsible for that transitioning. And I thought that was really cool detail. Mm-hmm. Also, and we can get to this, they're using an actual comic book from back then that was part of the John Byrne reboot of Superman. And I remember reading that comic when it first came out.
One of the writers must have been a comic book fan. I mean, there are so many little comic book digs and insights and, you know, just little small comments that link to comic books somewhere. You know, someone on this team must have been a comic book fan.
Peter Moffat has said, I saw an interview with him where he said that he's a huge superhero fan, and this was the best way he could think to work a superhero into Doctor Who. So it may have been him, since he was the scripter for this as well as the executive producer.
You know, it's interesting you said, Jimmy, that it was 1986. Something I had seen online said it was 1992.
Oh, you're right. You're right. It is 92. I did a mistake in my math.
Okay, because it was also supposed to be 24 years, in that gap, and that number 24 keeps coming up. But you know, 86, 92, I mean, it's just sort of, it's this long time ago and this big gap. So Grant wakes to find the doctor dangling outside his window and of his family's apartment, and helps him into the bedroom after saying, "You're expected." And this is, I gather, is the Christmas connection in this episode. This little moment we have here.
It's all there is.
Yeah, exactly. He offers some cookies and milk, and you see a Christmas tree in the corner.
Yeah. So the inference is the doctor's been mistaken for Santa Claus, and I thought actually this was a good move for them for a Christmas episode. To my mind, the one they did a few years ago with Matt Smith, A Christmas Carol, where they did a time travel version of A Christmas Carol, that was like the best Doctor Who Christmas episode possible. You know, other than visiting Bethlehem in AD in 3 BC, this is as Christmassy as you're going to get on Doctor Who. And everything else they've done since then, where they've tried to go Christmassy, has been weaker. You know, like when we saw the 10th Doctor's regeneration story in this town that's like that's dominated by Christmas shops, you know, on Trenzalore. It just totally undercut a lot of that with all the Christmas imagery and music and stuff. And I thought getting away from that and just having an ordinary adventure set at Christmas time opened up a lot of dramatic possibilities, and they didn't undercut themselves and allowed the story to kind of breathe on its own. So I liked how they had the kind of nod to Christmas time at the beginning, but then let the story proceed on its own logic.
Yeah, tying the Christmas episode to a Christmas story every time really is sort of a handcuff creatively, that, you know, they've delved into it and they're free to do that, you know, go back and forth. But, you know, a couple years ago was the sort of that the Facehuggers Christmas episode with Kris Kringle. And then and then last year was less Christmassy. It starts off on a planet where it's snowing. And this one kind of, again, even that little tiny bit. But, you know, I think you're spot on that. We it's good to kind of delve into it once in a while when the story lends itself, but not be too tied to it too much. Now, what's interesting here, I kind of like this moment, and Jimmy, as a comic book fan, you probably had fun with this, whereas the Doctor notices that Superman and Clark Kent are the same person and treats it as a giant revelation to young Grant, who looks at him like, well, of course, duh.
Yeah, I love the reaction that Grant has, where he says, "Are you serious?" And the doctor is, "Yeah," and he's like totally innocently serious. He's just made this amazing discovery; they're the same person.
but Lois Lane didn't know,
and she's a reporter.
Well,
yeah, a reporter.
And that ties into this episode, doesn't it? I mean, here we have we're going to encounter Lucy in a bit, this intrepid reporter who's a Lois Lane, analog. Yeah, exactly, and she is this brilliant person who gets these insights into the doctor. but can't even see the guy who, in front of her face, who, you know, happens to wear glasses and is this superhero. So I like that. Like we're kind of Moffat likes to kind of throw things right in your face, right up front, and then at the end, if you didn't get it, kind of say, "Well, I told you." That's kind of his MO with these things. So, but even better, I think even better than this gag about Superman and Clark Kent, I kind of loved his the Spider-Man gag where
Why vomiting... do they call him Spider-Man? Don't they like him?
Well, vomiting hair loss and death are not superpowers. it's really, you know, the sort of examining the tropes of these superheroes. You know, how often they get superpowers from weird things like radiation, which is funny because how often do we criticize Doctor Who in a lighthearted way, because we know we can't take it too seriously. But you know, the rabbit he pulls out of his hat and the Deus Ex Machina that he's always seems to have to get out of things. Exactly.
So one thing that I thought was interesting in terms of comic books. Now, people know the two kind of big comic book companies, DC and Marvel. And these days, Marvel is the more successful. It's got the big movie franchises. DC hasn't been able to do as well at the box office, although it's been doing better on television. And so there's kind of something of a fandom rivalry between DC fans and Marvel fans. And so you'd have a kind of creative risk if you went too far DC or too far Marvel in an episode like this. And I thought the balance they struck was interesting because the show is very clearly inspired primarily by Superman, and especially the first two Christopher Reeve Superman movies from the 70s. I mean, the scene on the balcony or on the top of the building, the roof of the building with the dinner is a direct homage to Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidder. But if they still wanted to work in Marvel. And so even though the plot is dominated by Superman elements, they have the Spider-Man series of jokes. And then if you look at young Grant's walls in his bedroom, they're covered with Marvel posters. And so they made sure to get a bunch of Marvel in there, even though they were going to be primarily focusing on elements from DC.
Right. Yeah, it seems to be a love letter to comic book fans of all stripes. You know, whatever kind of superhero you like, you know, we're not discriminating against. And that seems like another nice touch from people who are obviously fans of superheroes. So, the rooftop in New York, you know, everyone goes to the rooftop for whatever reason. That's in these brownstones. And so the doctor takes Grant up to the rooftop where the reason he was dangling off the side of the building was he accidentally set off a trap. I'm not sure for whom, for a device he was building.
Presumably for weeping angels.
Presumably, although the idea that they would get caught in a snare, it seems kind of odd. But he says the device is to reverse the paradoxes created. I think he's saying when the angels take Manhattan with Amy and Rory getting stuck back in time. So it's to sort of reverse the paradoxes. And I'm thinking to myself, wouldn't London need like 100 of those? Much more than New York? I mean, he's always creating all kinds of havoc in London. But whenever he goes, he's been to New York a handful of times, and every time he's gone there, something really bad has happened. So,
My sense of why they did that, you know, because that was the explanation for how to get rid of Amy and Rory without killing them, is, you know, they're stuck and they get to live out the rest of their lives in 1930s New York. And he can't rescue them because of all the time paradoxes the Weeping Angels have created in New York. And my sense was that this episode kind of puts a patch on that. He doesn't say he's going to undo all of those, but that he's going to kind of tamp them down so that I guess that's a way of opening up New York in the future without having to provide another big explanation for why can we go here now when we couldn't before. Oh, it's because the doctor set up this device in New York to kind of even out the time stream there in some way that wouldn't make sense in real life.
That's true, because that would shut off New York from, like you said, the 1930s up through the 19, I think it was the 90s or something, was said that Rory and Amy had died. So that's that. It reopens that possibility, I guess. Doctor Who's the show has never been shy about just kind of winking at something it said it couldn't do in the past and just saying, well, now we can, and moving on.
I think Doctor Who invented retcon.
Exactly. I like the reference. He says, the boy says he's got a cold. He always gets a cold at Christmas. And the doctor says, me too, or an invasion.
Yeah.
which is another nod to what this episode is about, which is yet another. I'm trying to think now. In the reboot of Who, every Christmas story except for maybe one or two has been some kind of alien invasion.
Right. A Christmas Carol was not an alien invasion.
Right.
And I forget whether the Voyage of the Damned, the one on the space Titanic, I forget if that had an invasion in it or not. I think that was just a disaster, maybe.
That was kind of a disaster story, Titanic disaster.
It was more like aliens were going to crash into the Buckingham Palace or, London and blow it up.
Yeah.
So it's sort of an incursion of aliens of some sort. So there's that little mention. And then the boy calls and we get the name of our episode here. Says, I'm going to call you Dr. Mysterio, which is the doctor seems to like very much. It seems to be a sort of a nod to Dr. Strange, but it's also a nod to something else, which is in Mexico. That's what Doctor Who, the series, is the show is called, is Dr. Mysterio. So it's kind of a funny little nod to the Spanish audience.
Apparently, the literal translation, Dr. K, doesn't make as much sense in Spanish as it does in English. So that's why they came up with Dr. Mysterio.
I'm curious, and maybe one of our listeners is a Spanish speaker and watched the show in Spanish, what they did with this in the show, in the versions that aired in Spanish-speaking countries where he's called Dr. Mysterio. Because then it has an entirely different sense, like you're calling him Doctor Who.
You kind of miss half the jokes of that's the Doctor Who.
Exactly.
You kind of miss those jokes, but.
So the doctor, absentmindedly hands the 8-year-old boy this little glowing thing and tells him that he's a doctor and to take a drink. There's this confusion. The boy thinks it's medicine, takes it.
I love the bit about he pulls the glass of water out of his pocket, which is kind of a nod to previous doctors who would have crazy things in their pockets. This is like the craziest of all. And Grant asks, how can you have a glass of water in your pocket? And the doctor just says, skills.
Yet another, like, hang a lantern on something and move it on. The doctor just does something impossible and just sort of nods at it and moves on. So,
by the way, doesn't this part now sound like a typical superhero comic book origin story?
Exactly.
Yeah.
What we're going to talk about now sounds just like a lot of superhero origin stories. Strange, mysterious traveler shows up and things go from there.
Right. Mm-hmm. And a miraculous device or, MacGuffin gives the budding superhero his superpowers and everything ensues from there.
And in fact, that's been used a lot with previous superhero stuff. So perhaps the most famous example would be Green Lantern, who was given the Green Lantern power ring by a Green Lantern from another planet. It's also been done with other things, including on television, such as with The Greatest American Hero back in the 80s, where William Catt is given a super suit that he by aliens, and then he promptly loses the instruction booklet. So he has to figure out his powers one at a time.
That was like the greatest show. I remember that when I was a kid. I loved that show. And one of the nice, the cool things here is another nod to Superman. The gemstone, the doctor says, draws energy from the nearest star, just like Superman gets his energy from the yellow sun. His powers. And the doctor says it's called the Ghost of Love and Wishes, which, when you think about it, is sort of the story, is that Grant becomes the Ghost of Love. It's a romantic superhero comedy. This story, and so Grant sort of becomes the ghost. It becomes a superhero name of love and wishes. It's sort of sappy, and I'll give Moffat a pass on that. But it's a bit, that's sort of the on the nose name of that gemstone.
Mm-hmm.
So
it also, some people, you know, point out it looks like a 20-sided die, or yes. It looks like some, you know, or a 12-sided die. Mm-hmm. And it does, but it also, to me, looked like, if you remember that episode of the original Star Trek series, Mudd's Women, where mm-hmm. the women take this drug that makes them beautiful. It actually, what he hands Grant looks like that. It's this kind of glowing red crystal polyhedron. And I wondered if there was a nod to Star Trek there.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting.
Well, and Grant, of course, says, well, you gave me water and a pill and I took it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're a doctor.
Do you trust the doctor? When the doctor leaves, now this is a part that kind of of contention for me. He makes Grant promise not to use his new superpowers.
Yeah.
Why? And I mean, obviously we know on the one hand, and we see it on Grant's face, is like, yeah, okay, I won't use superpowers now that I've got them. But like, you know, why is the doctor so opposed to Grant? Maybe not as a child, but even as an adult. Using these newfound superpowers for good.
The explanation that he gives on screen is that your powers are an anomaly. They're not meant for this world. And there's an element of truth there, but on the other hand, you know, the doctor is an anomaly that's not meant for our world, which Nardole points out.
Yes.
And so I thought, if you're in a situation where you've got a small child, extracting a promise to not use your powers when you're a young, irresponsible person could be a good promise to extract, but I would have built in some kind of clause about unless it's an emergency or till you're older or something like that. But I can understand wanting a child who's just been given amazing powers to not start using them all over the place, because that could lead to a lot of problems and even ruin the child's life.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'd think the doctor might stick around at least to see if the, as he puts it, if it passes.
Well, yeah.
But, you know, that's the doctor. Unpredictable and irresponsible at times, especially when it comes to children. So we see the adult Grant again. We're back to the adult Grant is being a nanny for this baby and this woman that he calls Mrs. Lombard. Mm-hmm. And aside from the opportunity to kind of trick the viewer and, you know, surprise us later, what in show reason, what in story reason would Grant have for calling Lucy, this woman he grew up with, who was a childhood friend, to call her Mrs. Lombard as, you know, as his employer? It seems odd. Did it strike anyone else as odd? I mean, is it the I'm the sort of dorky, very proper Clark Kent type? Sort of situation?
It could be. I would just attribute it to wanting to conceal the fact from the viewer. But even then, though, they hadn't introduced Lucy yet to us, so he could have called her Lucy. We wouldn't know who he was talking about, other right. than the fact that clearly establishes this is his employer. If he calls her Mrs. Mm-hmm. Lombard, if he called her Lucy, they might think is. Girlfriend or who is this?
Right. Or wife or yeah. That could have been.
And that was kind of my thought was, you know, it was kind of showing that there was the formality between them, that there was no, the relationship was purely employer employee, you know, that there was no interpersonal relationship there at all.
Right.
And I've known people that they're that formal where, you know, they will address their boss by Mr. So-and-so or Ms. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so or what have you.
Yeah, even though they may even be the same age or have known each other outside.
Exactly. Well, I guess, I think about how do we address priests, even if the priest is younger than us.
Right.
You know.
Father Corey, that might be an interesting question, a little side tangent. Do your friends and family call you father?
Most of them do. My parents don't, but they've known me long before I was father, so.
The privilege. They changed your diapers.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think most of my friends do, and I don't throw a fit if they don't. I mean, it's sure. not a big deal to me if they don't. I don't like it when some random stranger, oh, hi, Corey, how's it going? Do I know you? And I've had that happen. It's like, do I know you? I know you're Catholic, but. You know.
Yeah. Okay, that's sort of an interesting sort of tangent. I thought I'd throw that out there. So back in the story, we return to New York, and it's Christmas. It's 2016, presumably Christmas 2016, but you know, who knows? Actually, I'm gonna guess it's not Christmas 2016, given how much time they spend outdoors on rooftops without coats on.
Exactly.
So it's not. It's not no Christmas snow. In New York. and because I know, you know, New York is not like that at Christmas time. So and we see the doctor is back, and he's got Nardole. And now the ostensible return of Nardole is that he was rebuilt from Hydroflax's body, that his head was reunited with his own body by the doctor in some
right.
mysterious MacGuffin way off screen. But you know,
and for people who may not remember, Nardole is a kind of comic character from like the 54th century who was introduced in last year's Christmas special, The Husbands of River Song. And it, during that episode, he was decapitated and his head was put into a kind of robotic body with some other people's heads of an futuristic king named Hydroflax.
as only Doctor Who could do.
So nothing unusual there.
You know? Another day at the office. Now, the outside the Doctor Who universe reason for Nardole being here is this: he was just so darn popular. I think people just loved this character from last year, and the showrunners wanted to bring him back.
And they really developed him in this one too. He was very impressive part of the role, I think.
Well, he's got this.
The actor also expressed an interest in coming back, and they decided to bring him back. And apparently, he's going to be in like 7 or 8 episodes of the new series.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. Is that he kind of plays this role. He's a sort of foil to the Doctor. He seems mm-hmm. simple, you know. It's got this sort of simple, childlike quality, but then he makes these sort of incisive comments that kind of cuts through the Doctor's bluster and cynicism at times.
Kind of like the not, like where you talked about the not interference of the Time Lords.
Exactly.
He kind of threw that at the Doctor.
Yes, it's actually I think the Doctor always needs somebody around who's not simply just a companion who's wide eyed. At all of the wonder, but someone who can kind of cut through the baloney a little bit at times.
Mm-hmm. I think the implication here also is that the Doctor is using Nardole as a kind of surrogate for River, because Nardole was formerly River's henchman, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now that River has gone back to the library to meet her fate, the Doctor is kind of helping himself get over River and the fact she's no longer part of his life by hanging around with someone who also knew River.
Right.
And they kind of wink at that when Doctor talks about, hey, I reassembled your head to your body. Well, you did that because you're lonely. You didn't want to be lonely.
Right.
They kind of winked at that.
Yes. Yeah, because that's the one of the truths about Doctor Who that we always are told is the Doctor is not good when he's alone. And we've seen previous episodes where that's been a big part of it.
And so, they bring it back at the end where Nardole tells Lucy and Grant that the Doctor will be okay. I'll make sure of it.
That's right. So now we get into the heart, sort of the heart of the plot of this show, the alien invasion of this Christmas. We end up at Harmony Shoals, a multinational research company of indeterminate research and science, where there's a press conference going on, and we see this intrepid news reporter, Lucy Fletcher, this Lois Lane analog, and she's expressing some disbelief,
doubt
about what's really going on at this company, as they always do. They say at Harmony Shoals we're here to open your minds, and we find out that's actually a literal statement,
or like open your heads.
Exactly. I thought it was kind of the questioning was kind of odd. She asks this hardball question: why is it why do you have so many benefactors? Is it odd for a research institution to have a lot of benefactors? It was sort of this odd questioning back and forth. I didn't think it was the sharpest writing that Moffat has done in these sorts of things. But we it conveys this obvious idea that with this mysterious multinational company, and something bad is going on. We're introduced to Mr. Brock, who's the head of the company, and this Dr. Sims, who has the requisite menacing German accent, who has a very odd nasal problem. And
Blue's not.
Yeah, exactly.
And they resolved to meet at midnight. I'm not sure how many business meetings occur at midnight, why this is a thing. And why is it Mr. Brock want to meet at midnight? I thought it was odd, because at this point we know that Brock is not in on the conspiracy yet.
So this is weak writing. There's no good reason for that. And you're absolutely right about the press conference having weak writing, because Lucy's question doesn't really make sense, and neither does Nardal's, because they establish Nardal in this scene. This is the first we see of him. And his question at the press conference is, where is the little boy's room? And then we get into some kind of misunderstanding about, in America, men's bathrooms are called restrooms, or
right.
people... bathrooms are called restrooms, and he doesn't get that. And it's just weak writing. It's just to establish evil company, intrepid reporter, comic relief.
Right.
One thing I will say about the writing in that scene, though, that was nice is Mr. Brock is announcing that to the reporters that in the future you can get your questions answered either by Miss Siegel or Miss Schuster. And that's a nod to the creators of Superman, Jerry Siegel and Joe Schuster.
I was hoping you would catch that. I caught that. I was hoping you would too.
There's also, if I can take just a minute to note, a couple of linguistic nods to Superman along those lines. So Superman's secret identity is Clark Kent. So we have an alliteration on the K sound. And we have the same thing with Grant Gordon. Also, right. One of the recurring motifs in the Superman comics for years, for decades, was how people around him, now his name was Kal-El, his Kryptonian name, and each one of those names ends in the letter L, but all the people around him tended to have names that both began with the letter L. So you had Lois Lane, Lana Lang, Lex Luthor, Lyra LaRawl, Lori Lamaris, Lightning Lad. And that's why we have Lucy Lombard in this episode. The name Lucy is taken from Lois Lane's little sister, Lucy Lane. And the name Lombard is taken from Clark Kent's competitor, Steve Lombard. And so they've taken these two names from two Superman characters and stuck them together to maintain the LL tradition.
So Grant's competitor for Lucy's affections was a guy named Lombard as well.
Yes.
Oh, okay. That's the sort of thing, the little deep detail that it's sort of fan service to the superhero fans. That's a neat little bit of trivia there. So we move from the press conference to now presumably midnight, where Mr. Brock discovers that Harmony Shoals is secretly being run by a group of living alien brains that transplant themselves into any living creature they need for their plans, and Brock is killed and replaced. Now, we've seen the head-splitting aliens before. They were in last year's Christmas episode, The Husbands of River Song. And they're
going to be back.
Yes. Apparently that the Moffat, either he planned out from the beginning when he wrote them in last year, or just liked them so much from last year that he wanted to do them again. I'm guessing that they love the head-splitting gag in the visual effects department so much that they want to just keep doing it. And it's just so suitably gross that every time you never get over seeing that.
But it was
interesting. In the Husbands River Song, they identify themselves as coming from the shoal of the Winter Harmony, which is a suitably nebulous name, doesn't really mean anything, but it has that connection to this new company, Harmony Shoal. I love how villains always sort of just throw it right out there in your face. Like, we're not going to hide. This is who we really are. And they keep at it in this. So I like
how when the doctor shows up, the first thing he says is to Lucy is, "Don't worry, I'm a fellow intruder."
Yeah.
And then he's got this little box of sushi that he's eating, and I brought snacks.
Yeah.
The doctor's so blasé. He's done this so many times. He brings snacks with him when he breaks into places. A little dig at America. Brains with minds of their own. No one will believe that. This is America. But it's Nardole who kind of sees the seed of the alien plan when he notices that New York City is not a capital city, unlike all the other cities that contain Harmony Shoal buildings. So
the doc just kind of poo-poos, like, oh, you're being ridiculous. Go away. You know,
you're not here to point out the flaws. That's not what you're here for.
Yeah, exactly. And then Dr. Sims confronts Lucy and the doctor and Nardole. The doctor finds the flaw in Sims's plan to call them intruders by daring him to shoot them in the back.
Yeah, that was great. We'll be laughing all the way to the slab.
we have the little nugget that we have to hear, which is that the building is built to withstand the blast of 4 nuclear explosions.
This is a pet peeve of mine. It's like the in Hellbent or Heaven Sent in the previous season, where the wall he's got to smash through is 17 times tougher than diamond.
Oh yeah. You know,
just say tougher than diamond. Just say a nuclear explosion. Not 4 nuclear explosions. Nuclear explosions come in different sizes. don't just throw numbers onto things for no reason to make them sound impressive.
Well, that's the thing. It's even worse than the 17 times tougher than diamonds, because that's a real measurement. But how big of a nuclear explosion? A 1 megaton? A 10 megaton? Yeah. It's designed to say, later on when they say when the ship is going to explode, it's going to explode with the force of, you know, X number of nuclear explosions, and so this building will withstand it because it does one more nuclear explosion than that.
It definitely seems like the adult writer's version of I double dog dare you times infinity, you know.
yeah, exactly. It's just number inflation. It's bad writing.
It's a bit of a crutch that Moffat falls on, yeah.
Yeah, it's also Chekhov's gun. Because if you've established this building will withstand a nuclear explosion early in the episode, guess what it's going to be threatened with late in the episode?
Exactly. Although they try to kind of trick us by having Grant just kind of snap his fingers and break through a window designed to. So maybe, you know, we're supposed to believe that that's why he says 4 nuclear explosions, because Grant is stronger than 4 nuclear explosions. I'm not sure anybody bought that. But this we have.
I love.
Go ahead.
I love the line. It's more great dialogue in this scene. Would you like me to call a glazier?
Well, in Lucy's comment back to him, where, you know, he says, I love your column, and she says, you're real and you read. It's sort of the geek girl's dream boy, who the superhero who actually reads books. I think is the implication there. So then we kind of jump back for a moment to young Grant, where the doctor makes him promise not to use his superpowers. So we've seen that he's violated that promise already. And then back to the present, where Grant returns her to her Lucy to her apartment, and we have this reveal that Lucy is Mrs. Lombard, but he finds the doctor and Nardole waiting for him, having followed him there by the gemstone that fused with them. The doctor drops a couple interesting bombs on Grant for leaving this baby while he goes out to save the world. He uses that great Spider-Man quote, with great power comes great responsibility.
Right. More Marvel fan service.
Yes. Yep, exactly.
And a line which I think is might be my favorite of the episode, which is, no man worthy of the title leaves a baby alone. So
now, wasn't this where the 24 year got mentioned?
Yeah, it comes up, and it's sort of like, oh, it's been 24 years. It's sort of this absent-minded, like, has it been that long?
Yeah, I think what I got from that was basically that this story surrounds Husbands of River Song. That the elementary school age, if you will, the young Grant and then the teen Grant were before Husbands of River Song. Then the doctor went off to that, and then this is right after that.
I wondered if that was the implication, but I wasn't clear on it, because
then Nardole said something about it was a long night.
Yeah, and it, there's this is a time travel show. Unless you show us when he departed and left, or more clearly established it, it doesn't seem like there's any linear connection to the Husbands of River Song in that way.
Well,
and that's That one little, those two little lines just kind of made me say, okay, so the young Grant and the teen Grant was before, then he goes off and has the 24 years with River Song and then comes back. Now, of course, time travel being what it is, he didn't have to be gone for 24 years, but
right.
Again, and that's kind of slapping you in the face with it.
And he wouldn't absentmindedly come back 24 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey stuff that kind of drives us crazy, which as much as I love the show, I hate time travel because of the paradoxes. So, yep. So with all of this, you just got to hang a lantern on it. But it's this idea that this 24 years that he was with River keeps coming up. I think it's the main idea is just this 24 years that he's been away. I also like this idea where he says, where Grant explains his connection to Lucy. He knew her when he was a kid. She ended up marrying his best friend. He still has this pining for her. And the doctor says, thank you. And Grant says, who are you thanking? The universe. There's somebody worse at this than me.
And
given the number of disastrous romantic liaisons, attempted romantic liaisons with the doctor, that is undoubtedly a big accomplishment. But not to skip over to the adolescent Grant. I liked this idea that an adolescent fantasy, an adolescent male fantasy would have been to have X-ray vision. There's a lot of 13, 14-year-old boys who might think that it would be a great thing. But the truth is revealed here where poor young Grant, he can't look anywhere because it is both a curse, and a gift, not much of a gift, frankly, in the grand moral scheme, but it's a curse as well because he can't look at anybody. But this is how we reveal that he's a big fan of Lucy.
Yeah, and I was kind of a little, I mean, I get the joke here, but I X-ray vision is not declothing vision. So, it's like you'd be getting a radiological view of all the people around you. It's not exactly exciting.
But hasn't that been, but it's sort of a nod to superhero X-ray vision all along. I mean, this is sort of been an inside joke of even for Superman, but for other superheroes who've had X-ray vision, this idea that it sees beneath the clothing if necessary. It sees.
You'll occasionally get a little joke, but when Superman uses his X-ray vision, he's not using it to see through people's clothes. He's using it to either look inside of them or look through a wall or something like that. Mm-hmm. You may get a little touch of comic relief with that joke, but that's not actually what he or other people use the X-ray vision for, because that would have no plot purpose
right.
in comic books. When superheroes have a power, it's for a plot reason. They're going to accomplish something serious, not just sophomoric with it.
I wonder if it's a nod to the Christopher Reeve Superman, where Lois Lane, in her interview asks him, what color is my underwear? And he gets embarrassed because she's standing and he says, I can't tell because you're standing in front of a lead lined planter. I think it was.
And then when she moves, he says pink.
Yeah.
And he also looks in her lungs and tells her she doesn't have cancer.
Right. Right. Mm. So in one sense they kind of have it both ways, I think it might be a nod to that sort of joke and an obvious appeal to the sophomoric humor of the situation.
And a Peter F. Stephen Moffat.
Yes. So Lucy now interrogates the doctor.
And it's great.
The one thing I don't get is Mr. Huffle. I don't understand Mr. Huffle and why. Why does she squeeze it, and why does the doctor talk? Why does it make the doctor talk because of it? Am I missing something?
I thought this was genius. I love the way that someone turns the tables on the doctor, because normally he's the one interrogating someone and telling when they're lying. And to have her use this squeeze toy and just setting it up, saying, this is Mr. Huffle, he feels pain. And then every time she thinks he's lying to him, she squeezes Mr. Huffle and he squeaks with agony. And the doctor can't even bear the thought of simulated pain on a toy and is therefore compelled to tell the truth. I love that. I thought that was great.
I get the sense that someone on the set, that for them this toy was excruciating to hear it do its thing, to make its squeaky noise, and so they set that up. I mean, I just feel like there's like some inside joke here on that. But it does get the doctor to talk. She sort of incisively picks apart the doctor and who he is. She's so smart and clever and doesn't even know that Grant is the ghost. And that's sort of, that's the joke. I mean, it's not so much a hole in the story. It's the whole joke, which is that Lois Lane never did that with Superman.
Admittedly, though, that's part of what's going on here. But also, in fairness, the ghost's costume is more concealing than Superman's is. Mm-hmm. It was Superman. He puts on the glasses and changes his hairstyle,
right,
to become Clark Kent. But with the ghost, he doesn't just wear glasses and change his hairstyle. He does both of those things. But he also, as the ghost, has this big mask that covers the central part of his face, and he changes his voice.
You know, it seems to me that there's a bit of an homage to Batman going on here as much as Superman.
Yes.
He's got the gravelly voice that so many of the Batman actors have used, going back to
Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton, yes. Yep. You know, that sort of become de rigueur for Batman. And you know, the mask and the bulky suit. The dark coloring is very Batman-esque. So there's something to that. Like we can give Lucy more of a break than we can give Lois Lane, at least.
I was gonna say, and I wonder if it's going back to that where, you know, everybody knew that, you know, Lois Lane or that Clark Kent and Superman were the same person, and he didn't want to make that same mistake.
Oh,
he wanted to make clear,
when the doctor pointed it out, so he wanted to make sure. Yes, that's a good point. That's a good point that he's learned the lesson from the doctor.
Yep.
From when he was a kid. So back to Harmony Shoal, the doctor goes to taunt the aliens and to give them to
burger.
Offer them mercy.
And a burger.
And a burger. Because he brought his snack with him. He says that there have been many attempts to conquer the Earth. Not one of them has succeeded. They all lost, burned, and ran. That's who I am. By this point, you know, we know that there have been several times where memory of the Doctor has been wiped from the universe. So it's not inconceivable that there's aliens who have not heard of the Doctor protecting the planet, I guess. So he's giving them this opportunity to run, which they don't take. Why does Brock keep a gun in his head?
Well, it's less likely to be discovered there than other places on your body you might conceal it.
I guess. I just like, you know, keep it in your waistband like normal people do. I mean, there's like...
Again, that, I wonder if that was the CGI people again. They really like that effect of him pulling a gun out of his opened head.
Well, again, it recalls the last season, the Husbands of River song, where the alien in the dining room pulls the ATM card of the future out of his head.
Oh, yeah.
So again, like you said, I think they just really like that effect.
Also, Moffat would have needed a way to visually remind people who these guys are.
It's true. Mm-hmm. They got to have a reason to open up the head to kind of show us that remember these guys are really alien. Nardole makes a really good point a revelation a bit. He says he was reassembled because the doctor would be lonely. Nardole knows why he did that and then accuses him of dissembling when the conversation turns serious. Nardole rescues the doctor from Harmony Shoal, from being shot at this point.
I love the way the dialogue plays out there, where the doctor protests that he's trying to save the world, and Nardole says, yeah, that always happens whenever the conversation turns serious.
Exactly.
Nardole took the long way around to pick up the doctor, too.
Yeah.
He went to 12th century Constantinople.
Yeah, that was great.
And
firmly but wisely.
Right. And this is where that line comes in, where what you mentioned earlier, Father Corey, the he's not supposed to be using those powers. He made a promise. And Nardole says, "You mean like the Time Lord promised not to interfere in other people's affairs?"
Yeah.
And so they track down this low-rent freighter in orbit around the planet and board it via the TARDIS. And then they discover the ship's reactors is going to go critical, and Dr. Sims drops the hint that he's going to drop this exploding ship on New York to sort of set off this panic around the world that would then send all the world's leaders to the closest building to them that would be safe from such a thing, which would be the Harmony Shoal building in every capital in the world.
Right, because the only building in New York to survive will be the Harmony Shoal building. And therefore, that gives people, world leaders elsewhere, a reason to go to the other ones. Although, actually, there is a building in New York that's designed to withstand a nuclear blast. It's called Titan Point. And it's used as a kind of communications hub and as an emergency facility in case there's ever an actual nuclear war.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And presumably the presidents and others wouldn't go to the buildings that they already have that can withstand nuclear blasts, like the place out in West Virginia, something Meadows.
The presidential bunker, yeah.
Yeah, there's a couple of different bunkers around, again, you know,
Mount Weather or whatever it is.
Yeah, Mount Weather, that's what it is. Let's see. And then while all this is...
If you're in Switzerland or something, you may not have your own nuclear bunker.
Right. Although those banks might have something that could survive.
That's true.
So while all this is going on overhead, Grant and Lucy, or Grant as the ghost and Lucy, are having a interview/date on the roof of her brownstone, which is kind of going in this sort of awkward direction. Lucy, you know, realizes how she feels about Grant and starts to pull away from the ghost and is waxing rhapsodic about Grant's integrity, even as he sits there going, I'm not all that have that much integrity. I'm wearing this mask in front of you. Wants to reveal himself and can't.
Right. I love how he's just on the verge of revealing himself when something she says about Grant's honesty forces him to put the mask back on. So when we get the reverse angle shot, he's suddenly wearing it again.
Right. If you just look up that excruciating moment where she's like, why is she staring at her lap? And then we're back to the doctor and Nardole on the imminently exploding spaceship, where the doctor observes, why doesn't our side have plans like that? They have humans have no plan, says Dr. Sims. They have a plan. Me. But I love his observation. The other side, they always have the best plans.
Yeah.
Well, that's because the doctor bumbles into situations. He doesn't sit down and say, okay, here's how I'm going to take down the Dalek Empire.
Right. He sort of just kind of, you know, messes his way toward solutions, which he does again in this case. He's just sort of, I'm about to have a plan now. As soon as I think of it.
They kind of wink at that. It's, well, time for plan B. Well, what's plan B? I don't know. I'll let you know when I think of it.
I appreciate that writing, but for me, it's wearing a little thin because it feels a little familiar.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, there's another line here that I was a little confused by. Where Nardole says, I know you miss her, but could you just write a poem? He says to the doctor, who is her? It's not Clara. Do we assume that it's River?
I would assume so, since that's Nardole's connection to the doctor is in context of River rather than Clara.
Yeah.
And wouldn't we still assume that the doctor doesn't remember Clara?
I think
or not well.
Yeah, I think it's safe to assume that we're... We are where we are at the end of the previous series, the previous season, where his memory, if any, is at best hazy.
It's hints and myths and rumors more than an actual memory of her.
Right. And I'm still fascinated with this idea of Clara and me traveling around the universe in a TARDIS, but that's a whole.
I'm sure Big Finish will have a whole series of audio plays about that for your listening enjoyment.
Exactly. So back to the interview slash date on the roof. Grant and Lucy are captured by the brains, the Harmony Shoal brains, who want the ghost's body because it's the strongest thing. You know, if they could control that, they control the planet. Grant breaks free, and you know, as the ghost, and returns as himself, as Grant, and then picks up a message from the doctor, asking for his help to stop the alien ship that's about to crash into the city. I had a real Michael J. Fox vibe here from Grant. Did anybody else have that feeling? Especially in this scene, it just had this feeling of Michael J. Mm-hmm. Fox in Back to the Future.
He's got a kind of vulnerability.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's in a heroic situation. He's going to do what he needs to do.
Exactly.
Yes. So Grant reveals himself as the ghost by stopping the ship before it hits the rooftop, holding it up with one hand, his left hand, of course.
Yeah, because he's holding the baby monitor with the other. Yeah. One of the things that I really like that they did in this episode was they made him the nanny. And he's got that great moment where he comes back up onto the roof. He's disappeared as the ghost, comes back up as Grant, and it's like, I'm the nanny. Yes. And he's going to protect that baby, and that's really awesome. but I also liked one thing they did where when he stops the spaceship, he's holding it up with one hand while he's standing on the roof of a brownstone. And if you think about the physics of that, it's totally ludicrous because, assuming his hand is invulnerable, it would just plow through the nose of the ship. And even if it didn't plow through the nose of the ship, the building would not support the weight of him and the crashing ship. And so, this is preposterous physically, but what it also is perfectly in tune with comic book physics. Yep. And this exact thing has been pointed out in the comic books, that the physics of this kind of stunt just wouldn't work. And so they've provided rationalizations in comic books for how it works. And the standard rationalization, or one of the standard rationalizations for how Superman can get away with things like this, is his super strength and invulnerability is really a telekinetic field. And so in this situation, he would be telekinetically seizing the ship and neutralizing its inertia while simultaneously telekinetically levitating himself above the building so that the building doesn't get crushed.
You know, I have to take a pause here and recommend a series of books for people. Anyone who might be who likes superheroes, but has this tendency to want to have those explanations for things. There's a series of independently produced books called "Wearing the Cape" by this author. His name is Marion Harmon, and we dropped off. Father Corey. Father Corey, welcome back. Sorry, if folks heard the noise on the recording.
I just all of a sudden got lost. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Skype problems. So this series of books by Marion Harmon, which posits this event, and it doesn't really explain why the event happened, but this event where suddenly people become superheroes of various types, all kinds of different superheroes, supervillains, and they sort of have these explanations of how these things can happen within a game, within a story world, sort of physics, and you gotta take a look. I think you can get like the first 13 chapters of the first book for free. But if you like superhero stuff and you like to stuff that gives you explanations like that, I would recommend it. Just a little side tangent. So we also get speaking of him as a nanny. Lucy says to him, I prefer this superhero costume, the one he's wearing, which is, of course, his regular Grant clothes, because he's the really a superhero as a nanny, which is a sort of an awe moment.
And puts his glasses on.
Yeah,
exactly. His glasses is his superhero costume. We get a reference to UNIT. UNIT has come in to save the day. They're closing the head office. Did anybody else get that joke, that pun?
Oh, yeah.
The head office.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And as you're about to say, go ahead.
We get a reference to that one of the UNIT officers says, we're putting a call into Osgood. Everyone's favorite UNIT nerd.
UNIT operative.
Exactly.
And we have the intimation that one of them has been head replaced.
Exactly, yes.
Which means they'll be back.
Right. Yep. We see Dr. Sims' creepily empty eye sockets and a UNIT officer who's got that telltale scar across his face, which apparently nobody sees. It must be like superhero glasses.
Yeah, apparently none of the other people found the guy with no head, with no brain in him anymore, and wondered what happened to it.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, they did find him and pointed it out, and that was, and even then they don't wonder where it happened to him. I mean, it's just so weird. Yeah. So then we go back to the end, the wrap up. We're back at Lucy's apartment, and Grant tells the doctor that he will no longer use his powers. Exactly. You know, tell me you're not going to see a car crash about to happen, and you don't run out and save them. That promise, it never works in any superhero story.
What that really is, I think, is an excuse to not have Grant come save the day every time the Earth is in trouble, because the doctor says, "Leave it to me; I'll take care of it."
Right. Well, yes, that's another one of the key problems with all superhero stories is, you know, when the Earth is threatened in a Supergirl book, where's Superman? That sort of thing. But that's one of the things you just kind of nod at and accept and move on. So Lucy, again, perceptive, asks the doctor, why are you sad? And he doesn't give a straight answer, of course. As it is, because the doctor never gives a straight answer when a twisted one will do. But Nardole reveals that he's still mourning the loss of River Song, but will hopefully recover. And he kind of says, "I'll stay with him to help him." What does he say? Is everything ends and it's always sad, but everything begins again and that's always happy. Be happy. I'll take care of everything else. And I wondered, as I heard that, is that Stephen Moffat, who has said that this might be his last season with the show. Is that him kind of is giving his little prefigurement of is it that him speaking to the audience? Is that what I'm trying to say?
I don't know. I thought he was, you know, pressing on the fourth wall there, but I interpreted it in terms of the end of the one era with Rivers, with Clara, and then River Song, and now we're about to begin a new era with the new companion, who's going to be a woman named Bill.
Yes.
But he's still got a whole nother season with us, and I expect he'll be doing his big denouements with the Weeping Angels and stuff at the end of that.
Okay. Anyone else have any thoughts on the that statement, or just I thought it was a sort of pretentious moment. Mm-hmm. So we know that Nardole, as you said, Jimmy, he stays on. We get a preview. In the American broadcast, we got a preview of a little look at what season 10 will have for us. We have this new companion, Bill, who seems to be a bit of a return to the Donna Noble style of companion, which is she's not a romantic interest. She's a foil in some senses for the doctor, and you know, that's nice to have. It's sort of a palate cleanser. It's to have a little something different every once in a while, which is nice. And then, as you said, Nardole will stick around for at least some of those episodes.
Most of them, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, it's I forget how long. I don't know if we know how many episodes.
It's either 7 or 8.
The number 7 kind of sticks in my mind too, is what I've read.
It seems like every season gets shorter and shorter. There's not enough Doctor Who. so that's the episode. You know, how do you feel about it? Was it worth the wait? How does it stand up among Christmas episodes for you?
I have not been a fan of a lot of Stephen Moffat's writing and the shows he's produced for some time. And I just loved this episode. I thought this was the most fun Doctor Who has been in a long time. And it may be the most, the episode I've liked the best of anything Peter Capaldi has done. Oh. I really liked this episode, and I'd had a blast with it, and I hope it portends what we're going to get in the next season.
How about you, Stephanie? What is your sense of where this fits for you?
I would say the same thing as Jimmy. I thought it was very fun, and the feedback that we got on the Facebook page is kind of the same thing. People think it was very fun, and they enjoyed seeing a different way of Capaldi being in, very lighthearted and fun. So I enjoyed it very much.
And Father Corey?
I guess I'm going to echo everybody else. I mean, it was just a fun story. Yeah, I mean, we've kind of torn it apart a little bit as we talk about it, but it was just kind of a fun story. It did, you know, it was interesting. My first thought when I was watching it the first time was that first, you know, few minutes where it was the superhero origin story. It was kind of like, this doesn't seem like Doctor Who. But then as it got into it, it's like, okay, now I see where it fits, you know. Because the first few minutes, like I said, it was a superhero origin story. Strange Traveler comes in, gives device to young kid who makes him into a superhero, you know. And that didn't feel like a Doctor Who type story at first. But then, of course, as the story went on, it really did mesh in very well. It was just a lot of fun. It was kind of a blast. It's one of those episodes where you kind of look at your watch when it's done. It's, oh, that was an hour already, you know.
I had something of a different reaction when they pushed into that comic book page at the very beginning of the episode and took us inside of it. I thought, oh no, this could be an indication that what we're about to watch is not a real story. It's like another alien headcrab episode where everything's an illusion. Yep. And I thought, there's no reason to do that, because with all the crazy science in Doctor Who, you could totally have superheroes in the Doctor Who universe and they would work. I mean, couldn't very easily put a superhero into Star Trek or Battlestar Galactica, but you totally could Doctor Who. And so I was really glad that they didn't have this episode be an illusion or a dream story or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel the same way. I felt it was light. It was fun. I really enjoyed Husbands of River Song. I thought it was a great episode, and it had that one had a little more emotion to it in that goodbye to River. But this one was light and fun, and just a real nod to it was sort of madcap. It was a rom com. It was a superhero story, and it was a good taste of Doctor Who as we. Wait for the new season to get here finally. We're looking forward to a new season of Doctor Who coming up.
One thing to tide people over, if they liked this episode and they'd like to read more about Doctor Who and the Ghost, there is now a Doctor Who and the Ghost comic book that you can read. They're doing a series, I'm not sure how long it's going to run, at least two issues, maybe more than that, called Doctor Who Ghost Stories. And the first issue is already out. You can go to comixology.com and purchase the online edition, or go to your local comic book store and ask for it.
Oh, that is awesome. I'm going to have to get my iPad out right away after this and get that.
Exactly. That sounds
a lot of fun. Well, that's great. So that's it from us at the Secrets of Doctor Who for now, until we've got the new series that begins, as we said, in April. So stay subscribed to the feed. We had kind of suggested that maybe it might be fun to take a quick run back through last season, again with a fresh eyes based on, you know, everything we know that happened in Clara's final season. That's on the table. We may or may not do that. If you're interested in that, that might be sort of, we'll take two episodes and do them in a half hour, sort of a quick little discussion, not full-blown episodes like this. If it's something you're interested in, leave us a comment on Facebook or on our website at tridio.com. That's another thing I should mention is you can find our podcast now at tridio.com, T-R-I-D-E-O.com. We're still the same SQPN, but we decided to get a name that was easier for people to remember and share. And so Tridio is our brand for our channel for all of our podcasts. We have many fine podcasts there. We encourage you to go look at them. We've added a few since the last time we've had an episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who. Until then, Jimmy, where can people find you online?
They can check out my website, jimmyakin.com. That's JIMMYAKIN.com. And they can also check me out on Facebook.
And Stephanie, where can people find you online?
I'm on Twitter and Facebook as Angel Steph and Angel Steph 621 on Instagram. And my website is TVRewindPodcast.com. It's a site that has the regular podcast is about regular TV shows that are on now. And then we just launched 3 new shows to talk about shows that have been on in the past. So definitely would recommend checking it out.
Excellent. And how about you, Father Corey?
Well, probably the easiest way to find me is Facebook, Twitter, is a lot of those social media. I'm Fr. Corey Stika. Again, Fr. Corey, C-O-R-Y, Stika, S-T-I-C-H-A. Also, my website is frcorey.org.
Right. And you can find me at at B-E-T-T-N-E-T or betnet.com. You can find all the links to all our social media and connections on the show notes at tritio.com. Until you hear from us again, everyone, thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.
When will I see you again?
Soon, I expect. Or later. One of those.